Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're talking with Tawny Alvarez, who is back from the law firm of Farrell Dana. Welcome back, Tawny.
Thank you for having me, David.
Well, we're glad to have you back on this wonderful day. Hey, you know, so we're going to be talking about a topic that I'm not sure everybody really knows about. So I think this is one of those times where we're going to educate people out there. And I'm just going to say the topic, it's affinity groups, and I'm going to let you explain what that means.
Perfect. So affinity groups are something that we're seeing more and more in the workplace, where we have groups of individuals who identify with each other based off of a certain element of their lives, whether or not that is based off of religion, sports, gender, working, if they're parenting and working, if they are of a different race or ethnicity. Those would be the types of affinity groups that we see, not always in the workplace, but always kind of in life. So oftentimes we'll see affinity groups that naturally are created, right? People like each other. They have the same sense of humor. They eat lunch together. That, in a very loose term, would be an affinity group in the workplace. But what we're seeing more and more of is company-sponsored affinity groups. And the companies are using these affinity groups as a way to recruit, retain, and add to their company culture.
You know, as we think about these affinity groups, I think there's always been affinity groups, right? Sometimes people perceive those as those people become a clique in the organization. They can create sometimes a little niche of their own, and people sometimes say, hey, whether it's in an organization, whether it's in an association, whenever it's in another group, that these little cliques form. And that can create issues within the workplace.
It most definitely can create issues. And it can create issues organically, just because certain people are hanging out with each other, spending time during the work day or outside of the work day together. And then simultaneously, if it is a company sponsored affinity groups, it simultaneously can create risk for the organization. So while there are great benefits to having affinity groups, it promotes diversity, creates more cultural awareness, could increase employee job satisfaction because you have groups of individuals who are talking about what they'd like to see their work environment look like, or changes to the organization, it simultaneously comes with risk. And you know me, I always love talking about risk.
Yes, you do. You know, so a company creates a group. So let's separate this. So affinity groups from a, if you want to say, personal side, personal groups that get together, you could say Facebook groups that get together, or, you know, like we said, cliques within an organization that, like, all the mothers get together to talk about their kids, all the fathers get together to talk about sports, or all those type of groups. So a company puts it together for a project or for, you know, tell me a little bit about why a company would create an affinity group to start with. You gave me all the reasons, but I mean, really, why? What's the genesis of doing it?
The genesis of doing it would be in order to find out how this group of individuals feels about their work environment and if there are things that the company itself could be doing to better attract and retain this segment of the population. It also could be that some of these affinity groups are created organically, in which the company doesn't initially have a goal with its creation, but that ultimately something is created. Now, I say there's these organic groups and then there's ones that are company created. I think at a foundational level, the best thing to guard against risk for any company to do is as soon as they realize either the need for an affinity group or that one naturally is created that they could derive benefits from, that they create a policy. So they have a policy that references affinity groups and how the company is going to handle affinity groups in a multitude of different ways.
So you're talking about a policy that, because as I think this through for a minute, so in some ways I could see this being for team building, right? To certainly create interdepartmental groups or cross-functional departmental groups, across team groups. I can see many reasons for doing this. So when you talk about a policy, how is that different than a communication policy? Or is it part, or is it a subsection of it?
So let's do a scenario. You know, sure, how much I love scenarios.
Perfect.
So let's say you have an LGBT affinity group, right? And the goal is to attract and retain more individuals who are active members of the LGBT community. And that is the what the purpose of this group is. You don't have to identify as LGBT to be a part of it, right? That's going to be the that's going to be first thing that you're going to include in your policy, right? So if you have an affinity group that's based off of this certain group, you're going to want to make sure that you are not discriminating against anyone in their membership based off of a protected class. So if you had a sports affinity group, you're not going to say, okay, only white men can be a part of the sports affinity group. If there are women who want to be a part of it, young women, old women, no matter what, we're not putting parameters around who can be a part of this affinity group. So let's say you've created an affinity group and Mary has been a part of the affinity group and she's taken this leadership role in the affinity group, right? So she's putting more and more time towards what this group's going to do, whether it's activities outside of the office, educational opportunities inside the office. But Mary's performance is really decreasing. She's not doing great in the office, right? So if you tell Mary she can no longer be a part of that affinity group, what type of retaliatory motive does that have? Is it because she was actively pushing an agenda, which was the purpose of that affinity group? Or was it because she wasn't performing up to par during her performance review? If you don't have a policy in place that says who can or can't be in an affinity group, if it's a company-sponsored one, then you potentially have this issue as to what do we do with people who are putting more and more time into an affinity group and less time into their job.
We're talking with Tawny Alvarez, employment attorney with Verrill Dana and a great sponsor of the HR Power Hour. I'm your host, David Chulo, and we're talking about affinity groups. You know, when I think about this, you know, it's interesting that you say that there should be a policy for this type of thing. What if it's an informal affinity groups? Because every company has them. Is that something that organizations should look at from a policy perspective? If, I mean, I just can think about companies that have cliques and niches, and you know, I'm not saying that nobody discriminates against others, but it does. There's a unwritten rule maybe behind the scenes.
There's an unwritten rule definitely for your management employees. So this goes back to, every time you and I talk, I harp on management training. So you know what a big believer I am in appropriately training your managers and having the right people in the right positions. So if you find that one of your managers or supervisors have become a part of this affinity group that isn't company sponsored, one of the things you're going to want to remind them of is if someone during the course of discussion starts talking about something that they believe is unfair or unlawful, or they believe one segment of the population is making more money than the other, or the parenting employees have more leave time and it's unfair and accordingly are making either more or less money, right? Any of those type of, I don't want to say complaints, right? Because usually in an affinity group, you're going to have people who are setting forth problems, but likely not attempting to fix it if it's an organic one. So you'd want to make sure that your managers are trained to identify times in which whistleblowing is occurring or in which other complaints of discrimination or harassment are coming up that need to be shared with HR or other members of management. So I think that would be one of the first things you would look at.
So let me ask you this. I'm trying to put my head around for an organization that has maybe 15, 20 people and has, you know, some people have been together 10, 15 years, maybe the founders and a couple other people, and they know each other. And is there a risk of, you know, organizations ignoring this type of stuff? Is there a risk to ignoring? We're going to talk about in the next segment a risk specifically, because I want to talk about the legal side of this, but as we're trying to explain it here. Tony, is there a risk to damaging interpersonal relationships between people because of, you know, having these affinity groups and people feelings being hurt and so forth?
There most definitely is that risk. I mean, the whole purpose of an affinity group usually goes to something fundamentally with the culture of your organization, whether it's the need to change, the need to diversify, those type of issues, whether or not it is something that is occurring naturally or it's something that's company sponsored. So when a company creates a affinity group, normally it has a plan in place as to what it wants to accomplish. What is the end goal of this affinity group? It might continue once the end goal is met, but then what the purpose statement, I guess, is a really good way to say it, might evolve over time. You have even more risk when you have, I don't want to call it rogue, but rogue affinity groups that are created, because when management's involved in that, there's this heightened standard that they have. And you also don't know how much bashing is occurring of other individuals or protected classes, right? I think that there is definitely a preconceived notion that when a bunch of women get together, there is likely male bashing going on, right? So if male colleagues are overhearing, I'm getting some looks. I don't know. Maybe it's just when I get together with female, when I get together with female friends, there's male bashing. No, no, but really. So when they talk about things that are unfair, I mean, you hear that so often in the workplace.
Sure,
it's unfair.
Yeah.
Why is it unfair? Is it unfair because he's a man and I'm a woman? Is it all of those things potentially are going to come up? Now, if this is happening in the lunchroom, it's just a bunch of people sitting around during lunch. We have the issues with exclusion. Do some people feel excluded from this quote unquote affinity group that they can't eat lunch with them? And also, what are people overhearing? Are there issues with regards to maybe it's political statements? So you have a group of individuals.
It's almost like harassment.
Correct. It's creating a form of harassment in the workplace. So that is definitely one overarching issue and concern that we have with affinity groups that are naturally formed.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. We're going to be right back with Tony Alvarez from Verald Dana, and we're going to talk about the risks, the true risks to your organization and how you can lessen them. And we'll be right back.
Allergies, pollen in the air, dogs in the house, mold in the basement. Whatever triggers your allergy symptoms, it can really hold you back. Break through with Allegra 5-in-1 Relief. Allegra works fast, won't make you drowsy, provides 24-hour multi-symptom relief, and it's effective every day. Break through allergies with Allegra. Starts working in 1 hour, use only as directed. Guaranteed or your money back. Visit Allegra.com.
At 154 years old, Verald Dana has an illustrious history and more than 7 generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across 7 offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verald Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verald Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at veraldana.com.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB 100.5 FM, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're talking with the one, the only, Tawny Alvarez, and she's an employment attorney with Verrill Dana, one of the great sponsors of the HR Power Hour. I'm your host, David Chulo, and we're going to be talking about the risks to having affinity groups in the organization. We talked a little bit, Tawny, about what an affinity group and why you might do it. Now let's get into the legal side. Nothing you know much about, but let's talk about that anyways. Just kidding. Talk about the legal side and what the real risks are. We talked about harassment a little at the end of the segment. We know what harassment can be for a risk, but talk a little bit about having the policy, what the risks are, and so forth.
Yeah, so within the policy, you're going to want to set forth with the purpose statement, which is going to create a guiding line. You're going to want to have someone who is in charge of the affinity group, right? Which I know seems counterintuitive because it should be this like group, almost kumbaya type, very comfortable place. But if you don't have someone leading the conversation, it very quickly likely will derail. And you'll find yourself with a group of people who are complaining about an issue, but who aren't attempting to find a solution to the issue, which is not going to assist in meeting the purpose that the organization has for the affinity group. So when the conversations diverge, you have the potential for allegations of discriminatory comments if members of the affinity group disagree and are open and honest about what is being said. So we have that one potential issue. So making sure that it is a safe place, but also laying down ground rules. So I know that I am kind of micromanaging what's supposed to be a very organic process where people are talking about it. But if you don't have ground rules that say, this is the way we will speak to each other, and this is what is an appropriate comment and an inappropriate comment, and that's foundationally likely in your policy and procedure handbook.
I was just going to say, isn't that in kind of like the communication side or the code of conduct or the ethics policy, whatever you have?
Absolutely. But when you get into this more informal setting where everyone's roundtabling and discussing, you see that formality decrease.
So talk to me a little bit about what an organization has for recourse, right? So talk about internally if something goes wrong, and then externally if it goes out on social media and they have a Facebook group or they have a LinkedIn group or they have a Google Hangout, whatever it is.
Yeah, so when it goes outside the organization, your recourse is quite limited, unfortunately, because they are discussing the terms and conditions of employment. So what they likely are talking about is protected under the National Labor Relations Act. So if you have your organization, X, Y, and Z Bubble Makers, right? X, Y, and Z Bubble Maker employees create the subgroup on Facebook, and it's public. It's not a private subgroup. And they start talking about, well, it's unfair that they're not paying us overtime for hours worked in excess of 40, or so-and-so is a horrible boss, and I hate when he yells at me to tie my shoes. Those type of things, right? You can have some of these. I mean, a case came down yesterday in which the Facebook post was riddled with vulgarities, and the court said that it was protected because it was talking about terms and conditions of employment. So you lack significant resource there once it gets online. So by having rules in place, you can have discipline based off of violation of those rules, kind of by saying like, hey, this affinity group, this was the outline of what we're asking you to do. you can continue to post, but you need to understand the effect that it's having and whether or not you're moving the ball forward. In addition to the harassment type issues that you're potentially dealing with, there's also some really tricky wage and hour issues that come into play.
Yeah, I was just thinking to myself that if somebody's posting when they're not working, or and they're, even if they're doing it on a social side, you know, there's a risk of having to, you know, is that work? Is that not work? I can see some real risks to that.
Or what about if the affinity group's hosts or finds this benefit walk or some other charity event or organization that's doing something similar that they want to be involved with? If you get together a team, let's say of employees, and you say, okay, the affinity group is going to support this and we're all going to attend. Are you paying the employees for going on this, whether it's a walk for a walking fundraiser or a cleanup or any other type of outside event? Is that compensable time for your non-exempt employees?
Can you make in your policy that affinity groups are volunteer? Can you create a, you want to call it a subsection, that, you know, this group is for external, like you would have volunteer time or something things in an organization? Can that be created? Can it be mandated?
It likely wouldn't be effective to mandate it. I mean, if we, in part because the meeting would likely occur, initial meeting would likely occur during work hours. So whether or not it's during the lunch hour, right? Because that's one of the big issues is, let's say the affinity group occurs during the lunch hour for these non-exempt employees. You then have to still provide them with a lunch hour or their lunch break, right? So if you make them attend the affinity group meeting, even if it's by choice, when I say make, like by choice, you've asked them to participate, yeah, right?
You have, yes.
So the chances of an effective group, affinity group working, where you say, you guys can get together outside of business hours and talk about whatever you want to talk about, but we're not asking you to do it. We don't want you to talk about any of the substantive work that you have. Go at it.
Yeah, I can really see that being a real dilemma. I mean, as I sit here thinking to myself, there may, this is just an aside now, maybe more risks to having them than not having them.
I would agree with that. And I think that as we continue to see more and more affinity groups that are being created, I think it's important for a company to weigh the benefits of having the affinity groups. Are there other ways in which you can accomplish the same tasks without the creation of an affinity group?
Yeah, it's more like create a project and then make it more of a work project rather than a loosely formed affinity group that doesn't have as strong rules behind it.
I think that's correct. And I think oftentimes why we see affinity groups started in the first place is in response to an issue, in response to a complaint, or in response to someone who is verbalizing a feeling or a desire from a group of people that we're unable to retain male employees, or we're unable to retain people over the age of 40. Why are we unable to retain these people? Not that we're terminating them, but because our culture isn't something that is making them feel as though they are wanted, or even veterans. I mean, looking at subclasses where you want to have a larger group of people to diversify your community, it becomes difficult to figure out how to do that without getting together the people who are part of that group to determine why they're happy here, what would make them more happy, how we can recruit similar or like-minded people.
So as we wrap up this short segment here, as we have a half show here with you today, and appreciate you coming in, Tawny. What are maybe like three key things that an organization should think about for formal or informal affinity groups that they should immediately remember from today's show?
I mean, the number one, the first one that I want you saying is, what is the purpose? Why do I want to create an affinity group? Second, who's going to be involved, right? If I want management to be involved in this, do I have the right people in the right place? So making sure that your managers are aware of what their duties and responsibilities are as a part of this either task force or affinity group, right? And then third, I'm going to go back to the purpose. By having these rules and purpose in place, are you accomplishing the task in which you had set out to accomplish? Because there's a chance that the answer is no, that after you have minimized the risk to a level that you feel confident in, are you still able to have an open dialogue with your employees and to obtain the information you need to obtain by decreasing the wage and hour risks as well as potential discrimination risks?
Well, this has been an insightful discussion in regards to affinity groups. I appreciate you coming in today, Tawny. As always, love having you on the show.
Thank you, David. I enjoy our time together.
Absolutely. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
When things come out of left field, having a game plan makes all the difference. Luckily, Farmers Insurance has been helping people cover their bases for 88 years, and they can help you too. Talk with an agent today so you can see if your coverage is ready for whatever curveballs may come your way. At Farmers, we know a thing or two because, well, we've seen a thing or two. Put our experience into play at Farmers.com. Farmers.com.
We are Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
Farmers.com.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by cmacareer.com and maine.dalecarnegie.com. Today, we have as our guest the one, the only, Tawny Alvarez. She is back for a second segment of today's show. Tawny, again, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you know, you're an attorney.
I am.
Yes, let's get it out on the table, ladies and gentlemen. She's an attorney with a great law firm, Verrill Dana. And have you ever told a client, flat out told a client, do not do X?
I likely have. So I'm not going to say I've never said it because I likely have, but I like to think that normally I say, you can do whatever you want, but I'm going to tell you how much risk is involved with each decision.
So tell me about behind the scenes, right? When a client is providing you as a client of yours and they call you and they say, Tawny, I want to fire this person. Let's just start. And we know that the emotions that go behind that. It's like, I'm going to fire this person. Doesn't really matter what you say. They're gone today. And you go,
okay, well, if nothing I say is going to change that decision, let's at least find out how much risk is involved and whether or not there's anything that we can do right now to minimize that risk in the half an hour or hour before you inform the employee that that is what is going to happen.
Do you find that there's a real emotional behind the scene? You know, is it the emotions that kick in sometimes more than the actual facts of the situation?
Absolutely. And in some work environments, there will be situations where it's a very difficult decision and something that they have been toying with or thinking about for an extensive period of time. And they only will bring an attorney in and kind of in those last few hours to make sure that they've done everything properly. And in that discussion, I'll oftentimes throw out multiple different scenarios, ways we can move forward. And then they'll sleep on it. And that's normally how I normally want people to sleep on it. So when I get people who call and say, we're doing it now, we decided to do it this morning, and we're going to have it done by this afternoon, those are the ones that I find more difficult because they're very heated. People are passionate. They're in the moment. And if they're calling me, it's oftentimes because there's something that they're unsure about with regards to the decision. So it's that much more difficult.
Or even better when they call and say, hey, we just did the termination. Now let's go through it.
The just did the termination one is that much more difficult because all I can do is listen and say, okay, we'll talk about what we can do better next time, but we can't change the past. So let's figure out if there's any steps we can take moving forward in an attempt to remedy this situation so that we either don't have bad blood with the employee or so that we're not looking at an administrative charge or a lawsuit.
So let's back to the front end. So at the hiring stage of a employee's life cycle with the company, do you ever get involved in the hiring side? Because we all know about the terminations. We all know about harassment. We all know about all the things that are like things that normally happen in the day-to-day. But how about on the hiring end? When is it appropriate to bring an attorney into a conversation when you're getting ready to hire somebody?
Absolutely. Oftentimes we'll see it when there's a red flag or something that's going to seem out of the ordinary to the employer, whether or not it's something that was said during the course of the interview that left them scratching their head. Oftentimes it's something that's been volunteered by the employee that wouldn't come through in a background check. So maybe our background check goes back 7 years and we know it's clean, but the person is going to volunteer information about something that happened a decade ago. So the question then becomes, how does that affect our decision, if at all? That's where having good policies and practices in place is important. But each situation is different. So depending on what the position is, what the requirements are, whether or not you've had other people in the position before who have been successful or unsuccessful, how much responsibility they're going to have, the team dynamics that they're going to walk into, a lot of those things will come into play. And oftentimes at a hiring stage, what clients are looking for is either a statement that reiterates what they've already decided or that provides them with a little bit of guidance about where their risk will potentially be in the future.
So on background checks, standard background check, about 7 years, sometimes they're 15, sometimes they're longer. Is there a rule of thumb as to what a reasonable background check is? Is there something that is like, hey, you have a better chance of going back 7 or 15 or 25 or lifetime? Is there anything, a risk around that?
There isn't really a risk. I mean, the EEOC, I believe it's 7 years is what their recommendation is, but I would never have a broad policy that applies to every single position of your organization that has the same exact standards, unless you have very, very high standards in so much as couldn't have committed murder, can't have fraud, those type of things. With the fraud ones, it's very difficult because if it was a financial fraud and the individual is going to have no access to money, then you question whether or not what is the purpose of doing that background check. You could say to determine whether or not they're a trustworthy individual, and there's those aspects. But if you're going to do something like that, I definitely want something in the job description or within the duties that indicates that trustworthiness is a necessary component of the job.
So is it okay to give somebody a 7-year background and then another position do 15 and another position do 25? And I mean, I know companies ask these questions all the time. Like, when is it appropriate to use what? Do I have to be consistent across the board?
You need to be consistent with regards to the position. So if you want to divide it up so that you have management level, that you're looking back a decade, non-management positions, you're looking back 7 years, other individuals in administrative roles, you're only looking back 3 years. As long as the subcategory of employment, you're using the same standards, that's all that really matters to me. Now, one of the interesting things that we often get a question on is employer who didn't have background checking but is going to institute background checking. So they've decided we're going to start background checking all new hires. Does that mean we should also do a background check as to all the people we currently have working? My question is always the one no one ever wants to get from an attorney, which is, it depends. What it depends on is, what are you going to do with that information? Let's say you have the stellar employee and their background check comes back and shows an OUI from 5 years ago, right? Does that matter to you? Is it an essential part of the position? Is it different if you find them pleading guilty to check kiting? What are you going to do with the information once you have it? And do you have standards in place as to how you're going to handle it?
Does this work the same with drug testing? Company decides, suddenly I want to institute drug testing within the workplace. And now I have, like, say, 12, 15 employees, 30 employees that already work for me, and I want to drug test them all. And, I mean, these are standard questions, right?
Absolutely, they're standard questions, especially here in Maine, with how high the standard is to institute and begin a drug testing policy. It's something that we definitely are going to want to ask the employer, what's the purpose? Do you have suspicions that people are already using drugs in the workplace? If you have those suspicions, could we just terminate based off of other issues with their performance? My goal most oftentimes when we're talking about drugs in the workplace is to focus on the behavior that has absolutely nothing to do with the drugs. Focus on their inability to perform the tasks of the job or within the job description, as opposed to their eyes appeared glazy or they were slurring their speech. Say a customer complained about your behavior, those type of things, and put it on the essential functions of the position as opposed to potential intoxicants.
So when a person goes through the process, they've done a background, they do drug testing, they're hired, and something goes askew. Not that that should happen, but it does. And they go back and, you know, an employer is looking and calling you and saying, hey, we have these issues. And they say, well, you know, I want to handle this the right way. I don't want to be sued. I don't want to worry about, you know, if it has to go to trial. How do you think an employer should, what should an employer do when they're thinking about the fact of, hey, I may have to somehow go and defend this in front of a jury?
Yeah, I want things in writing as soon in time as to when the event or activity occurred as possible. So if that's just an email on your phone to yourself when you're standing there talking to an employee and you shoot yourself an email saying, I just spoke to John about coming in late 15 minutes past when he should have been here. Even just those kind of random emails that are made in time, those are the things that I'm going to want. I want documentation. I want other witnesses, people who have seen behavior. So if it's with regards to absenteeism, I want a really clean record as to it. If it's with regards to the one I get most often, regards kind of FMLA or leave time. So someone's been out of work for a significant period of time. We want to terminate because we just can't keep accommodating this leave. Okay, show me why you can't accommodate it. Well, Tawny, we just can't. I mean, they haven't been here for 3 months. Okay, but what hasn't got done? Well, I don't know what hasn't gotten done because everyone's been picking up the slack. What kind of slack have they been picking up? Well, everything, because the person's not here. That answer isn't going to fly with a jury. I need to show lost profits. I need to be able to show projects that have fallen through the crack. I need to be able to show overtime that we've expended as a result. Especially with these leave issue things, that's where we find ourselves having to say, show me why you're unable to accommodate additional leave. With regards to sex harassment or discrimination, those type of issues, normally that's the stuff, behavioral issues, you'll see much more documented. But when we're talking about leave issues, people just don't document it. Oh, well, he would text me. Maybe I have some texts on my phones as to the days he was in or out. But it didn't really matter because he was getting his work done when he's here. So it's tough. So it's all over the place as to what the issue is. But with regards to leave issues especially, I want a very clean calendar as to when they were out, who had to do what, how you handled it. with regards to the behavioral issue, more often than not, I find employers are appropriately documenting those issues. So it's easier for me to step in and say, okay, this is the risk that we're looking at if we move forward.
Well, you know, employers, and I've said it before, want to do the right thing. The last thing they want is to deal with, a upset employee or an upset client or an upset any of these sort of things. They want to do the right thing, but emotions do come into play. And you do sometimes deal with expert witnesses that come in and, talk about the state of mind or use psychological, issues of, it's undue stress or undue whatever it is in the process. How does that affect or should that be an issue when an employer thinks about things being brought to a court?
It definitely should be an issue. And I joke in a non-joking way with clients when I'm doing a deposition prep, because I inform them that this will be the longest 4 8-hour of their life, right? It's going to be a lot longer than the deposition is, because I will be grilling them about every aspect of that time period, whether or not that includes, did you have a sick child at home? Were you distracted? How much of your energy was put towards your work at that time, right? Because that's exactly what plaintiff's counsel is going to ask. They're going to figure out, was this individual who's making decisions distracted? What did their personal life look like at the time? Were they going through a divorce? Did they have a sick child? Did they have an ailing parent who they were caring for? And during that period of time, did an employee's complaints, whether or not they were legitimate or non-legitimate, lead this person to say, I just need to get rid of this person because they're annoying me and I don't have the energy or the bandwidth to do it? That's the way any decision is going to be framed in most cases by plaintiff's counsel. So it's important that when we're talking before termination, that I'm having a conversation in which I'm trying to determine, does the whole team agree? Give me a bunch of examples. When you say that he or she isn't a good fit, what do you mean by that? Give me specific examples. Then when I hear, well, they were lurking in doorways during meetings where they weren't invited or that was above their pay grade. Okay, did anyone speak to the person about that being inappropriate? Sometimes people's lack of social cues doesn't in and of itself create an intention to do something wrong. It's just that they lack some social awareness.
We are talking with Tawny Alvarez. She's an attorney at Verrill Dana, employment attorney at Verrill Dana. And we're talking about some really interesting thoughts about how you should bring an attorney on board for even hiring or firing, or when to think about juries and what it means. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we'll be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Looking good, Mr. King of the Hill. Mr. DXL Shopperman. Mr. Sharp Dressing. Confidence oozing. Style swaggering fashion stud. Looking good. All the brands you love, waist size 38 and up. DXL, you're looking good. Find the biggest selection of polos and tees from Psycho Bunny, Lucky Brand, Tommy Bahama, and more.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by cmacareer.com and maine.dalecarnegie.com. And we're talking with Tawny Alvarez, employment attorney with Verrill Dana, And we're talking about some really exciting stuff, Tawny. You know?
Really
exciting.
We're talking
exciting. About when an attorney really needs to be brought into these conversations. I mean, that's the conversation, right? When do you really need to bring an attorney in? So we're talking about when an attorney should be brought into situations. How often do employers second-guess their decisions?
They should be second-guessing every decision that they make.
That seems like painful.
It is painful. It is painful. And one of the reasons you're going to get on the phone with me is so that I can second guess everything you've said. And you and I joke all the time that when we speak, I'm always the black cloud in the room because I will make you second guess everything you've thought of. And I will take what looks like a very simple decision and I will make it the most convoluted, crazy, risk filled decision that you'll make all day. And in large part, that's because I know that once we get in front of a jury or a judge or an administrative hearing officer, they're going to be asking you the tough questions. They're going to be asking why you made that decision as opposed to another. And with regards to the decision you didn't make, I'm going to want to know exactly why you didn't make that decision. And oftentimes, there's very good reasons behind why path A wasn't chosen, but path B was. But I need you to be able to verbalize why you're choosing path B as opposed to path A.
Not just because I want to?
Not just because you want to.
And but I do.
That's the hard part because so many people say, but it's at will, Tawny. Everyone says that it's at will.
At will, that's right.
You know, my least favorite, my most favorite words, it's an at will state. Absolutely, it's at will, which means that you get to make whatever decision you want as long as you can't couch it in something that's against the law. But I promise you, once you get on the phone with an attorney, I can couch anything as potentially against the law.
And that's really the hard part, right? And that's the part that we hear all the time is because it's an at-will state, why can't I just do what I want to do? And look, I'm running the business. It's my company. And it's not illegal. So why can't I do it?
And part of it is because of perception. We talk a lot about perception. Everyone experiences the same exact moment in a different way. So there's three of us sitting in the room right now, and we are all experiencing this moment right here in a very different way, same way that all of our listeners are experiencing this moment in a very different way right now.
They're all thinking about, do I really need to call my attorney? And they should. They should. They should think about it because, you know, in the reality is, what I like when I call employment attorney, call you, is the fact that you do make me think outside my little world and box. And while I still may end up making that decision, which I think is important to say, right? It's not that you can't make the decision. At least you know all the pros and cons as to why.
Absolutely. And when we started talking and you said, do I ever tell someone that they can't do something? Not usually, but normally I'm going to question them so much that they'll start second guessing themselves. And not just that, but they'll start the conversation off with what they believe are the pertinent facts. And then they'll say, oh, well, this also happened. Oh, well, this also happened. And I'll say, well, is that playing a role in your decision? Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, I need you to verbalize that. And that plays a role in why we're making this decision. It's tough because I know oftentimes people want to call me and they only want to be on the phone for 10 minutes. They say, this is quick, Tawny. This is all I need. And I definitely respect that. I'm very conscientious about those issues. But I also want people to feel as though they are confident in the choice that they're making and that they have enough support for the reason they're making it as opposed to another decision.
Well, you know, it is. Hey, look, time is money. On both sides,
absolutely.
Right? The cost of legal, but the cost of time and calling in. And most business leaders just want to do what they do, which
absolutely.
Is make a widget or do a service. And this is a pain sometimes to deal with, but people are necessary, and we need to make sure that we treat them right.
We do. And one of the things we talk about a lot, especially when we're ending the employment relationship, is make sure that you treat them with respect. Make sure that when you walk them out the door, they feel as though they've been given the utmost respect, that you're not doing it in front of their peers, that you're not yelling, that you're not screaming, that you're not allowing emotions to interfere with the process. It's a very emotional process, and I don't want to minimize that at all. But the more that you can keep it as a business decision, be very straightforward with the individual, and also let them know that you recognize that your perception of the situation is different from theirs, and that we're not all going to agree on any of it, whether or not they're a good performer or a bad performer. Very often are you going to get someone who is real, truthful, honest about their own performance, and who can truly look themselves in the mirror and say, these are my weaknesses, and I recognize and understand those, and maybe I'm not a good fit for this company.
Yeah, it does. And that takes a little of introspection, right? Somebody looking inside themselves. And that's hard. That's hard for people to do. That's hard for owners to do. That's hard for anybody, really, to do.
Absolutely.
And so to have a second opinion is a good thing to do. Lastly, as we wrap up the show today, when people think about the costs that go into something going wrong, I've heard a lot of numbers thrown out there, right? $500,000, $250,000, you know, $10. I'm sorry, $10, right?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes you might be able to, but probably not with me involved. No, unfortunately.
It's all right. The reality is that what can somebody, you know, really realistically think that this stuff could cost in terms of if it goes to court, what's the long term risk if they don't have a short term answer on the front end and get opinions?
Absolutely. And they need to be looking at that. And when I say like a dime now is going to save you a quarter later, like, yeah, you spending $500 now, 2 hours worth of work, something like that, which I think 2 hours for most decisions is going to be a lot. Maybe for some high-risk terminations, though it's not. But that's looking at saving you, yes, $400,000, $300,000. And that's literally just in a jury verdict. That's not talking about how much attorney's fees are going to put you back, how much plaintiff's attorney's fees are going to put you back if you're looking at a wage and hour suit or if you're looking at a discrimination suit. Unfortunately, the numbers are quite large. And oftentimes, yes, we're going to settle the case, but we're not looking at settling cases anymore for $500 or $1,000. It's just not happening. $30,000, $40,000, those are more realistic numbers right now, and that's at an early stage in a case.
It is crazy numbers, but something you should be aware of. Tawny, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
Hi, this is Tawny Alvarez at VeralDana. Has your company recently audited its risk for joint employment liability? Do you use a third-party vendor for temporary work or otherwise use contract labor? Have you recently assessed whether you are using best practices to decrease possible liability as to joint employment? Things that should be considered in this analysis include the interrelationship of operations between the two entities, whether there is common ownership and financial control of the entities. Whether the two entities have common management is also an important factor to analyze. Finally, whether there is centralized labor relations, that means human resources functions, or other centralized personnel that provide services to both entities. While each state has individualized standards to determine joint employment, these factors serve as the basis of many of the tests. To further assess your risk of joint employment, talk to a member of VeralDana's Labor and Employment Practice Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to do a rerun with Kevin Sheridan, national keynote speaker, New York Times bestselling author, and chief engagement officer of Kevin Sheridan, LLC. He's going to be talking about onboarding for full engagement. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.